Stone, Rolling Stone.
Wanna see our pictures on the cover?
Stone,
wanna buy 5 copies for our mother?
Yeah. Stone,
wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone?
This is Dan Klingel, volunteer reader for Some Sounds of Arizona. We're continuing to read from a Rolling Stone special collection edition on Paul McCartney, and we're in the middle of a very lengthy interview called Paul is Not Dead, and Neither is His Past. If you haven't listened to the previous recording, don't worry. These interviews jump from topic to topic. Your two big television shows were James Paul McCartney and Magical Mystery Tour. How were they conceived? Paul. The mystery show was conceived way back in Los Angeles on the plane. You know, they give you those big menus, and I had a pen and everything and started drawing on this menu, and I had this idea. In England, they have these things called mystery tours, and you go on them and you pay so much, and you don't know where you're going. So the idea was to have this little thing advertised in the shop windows somewhere called Magical Mystery Tours. Someone goes in and buys a ticket, and rather than just being the kind of normal publicity hype of magical, well, it never is magical really. The idea of the show was that it was actually a magical run, a real magical trip. I did a few little sketches myself, and everyone else thought up a couple of little things. John thought of a little thing, and George thought of a scene, and we just kind of built it up. Then we hired a coach and picked actors out of an actor's directory, and we just got them all along with the coach, and we said, okay, act, an off-the-cuff kind of thing. The James Paul McCartney show were these people who wanted us to do a TV show. And they said, you can do it any way you want. This seemed like a good opportunity to kind of get on the telly. So that one was just worked up that way. We met the guy when we went to Morocco. We were on holiday then, and they came out and sat around the pool. We talked about various ideas and came back to England and did it. Were you sorry Magical Mystery Tour was not shown in America? Paul. At the time, hey, I thought, oh, blimey. But it started out to be one of those kind of things, like the wild one, you know, Marlon Brando. At that time, it couldn't be released. The interest in it came later. You've got to be patient. Everything like that works out well. I think it was a good show. It will have its day, you know. You told me you still ask your friends, is this really good? And Linda mentioned that you still get nervous about your work. And so does this mean you watch critical notices very closely? Paul. No, I don't like criticism, whatever. I don't think I ever liked it when my dad said, I don't like your trousers. But I went through a difficult period where I started to listen to what the newspapers have to say about me and say, some guy would be sitting in New York all hung up thinking, well, that's not as good as I would have wanted. And I thought, well, blimey, that's only one guy. I'm not going to take it as gospel. Linda mentioned you bounce off people. After you left George Martin and the other three, was Linda the only person to bounce your ideas off of? Paul, for a while? Oh, yes. Did you miss not having more people? Is there anyone you ask now outside of people in the band? Paul, sometimes now I mainly bounce off myself. I do that more now. Call it what you will. Maturity. Sometimes if a friend is in the studio, I'll ask for their opinion, and that will make it easier for me. The laugh of all this is I say all this rubbish, and it all changes the next day. I still read the notices and stuff, and they're usually bum ones when you're expecting them to be great. There were a lot of bum notices after Rant. But I keep meeting people where I go, like I met someone skiing, and he skied past me. He said, I loved Ram, Paul. So that's really what I go by, just ordinary people. And they said they loved it. That's why I go a lot by sales, not just for the commercial thing. Like if a thing sells well, it means a lot of people bought it and liked it. Does that mean then that you didn't think too much in retrospect of Wildlife because of all your albums? Paul, No, I quite liked it. I must say you have to like me to like the record. I mean, if it's just taken cold, I think it wasn't that brilliant as a recording. We did it in about 2 weeks, the whole thing. And it had been done in that kind of a buzz we'd been hearing about, how Dylan had come in and done everything in one take. I think, in fact, often we never gave the engineer a chance to even set up a balance. There's a couple of real big songs on there that only freaks or connoisseurs know. Do you think Dylan has influenced you at all? Paul. Oh, yes, very heavily. I think the first time was in You've Gotta Hide Your Love Away. That was John's song. Then there was a good deal of influence in the Hard Day's Night and Help periods. Certain chords, the acoustic bit. We liked him. We met him when we came to New York. We were together a while. He came to one of my sessions when I was doing Ram in New York. You mentioned in the studio that you were influenced in a recent session by Marvin Gaye's Trouble Man. Do you think Fella or someone else might misconstrue this? Paul. Being influenced by something and stealing something are two different things. When you hear the track we did and hear Marvin Gaye's, you probably would never know they were related. I may be influenced by something, but it's in my head and doesn't necessarily show in the song. Here, There, and Everywhere was supposed to be a Beach Boys song, but you wouldn't have known it. It's been suggested that the Beatles provided something for Americans they had lost with the death of Kennedy. Youth, happiness, freedom from inhibitions. Does that make much sense to you? Paul. Nope, not at all. In songwriting technique, how did you compose with John? How did you compose yourself and then with Linda? Paul. Well, first I started off on my own. Very early on, I met John, and we then gradually started to write stuff together, which didn't mean we wrote everything together. We'd kind of write 80% together, and then the other 20% for me were things like Yesterday, and for John, things like Strawberry Fields, that he'd mainly write on his own. And I did certain stuff on my own, so I've done stuff on my own. When I said, how do you compose, I meant actually sitting down and doing. Did you use a guitar, or did you use a piano? Paul, when I first started writing songs, I started using a guitar. The first one I ever wrote was called My Little Girl, which is a funny little song, a nice little song, a corny little song based on three chords, G, G7, and C. A little later, we had a piano, and I used to bang around on that. I wrote When I'm 64, when I was about 16. I wrote the tune for that, and I was vaguely thinking then it might come in handy in a musical comedy or something. I didn't know what kind of career I was going to take. So I wrote that on piano, and from there it's really been a mixture of the both. I just do either now. Sometimes I've got a guitar in my hand, sometimes I'm sitting at a piano. Do you start with a title or a line or what? Oh, different ways. Every time it's different. All My Loving. An old Beatles song, remember that one, folks? I wrote that one like a bit of poetry. And then I put a song to it later. Something like Yesterday, I did the tune first and wrote the words to that later. I called that Scrambled Egg for a long time. I didn't have any words to it. Sings the melody with the words Scrambled Egg, da-da-da-da-da, Scrambled Egg. So then I got words to that. So, I say, every time is different, really. I like to keep it that way, too. I don't get any set formula. So that each time, I'm pulling it out of the air. The Wings tour in 1972 was the first time you had toured in 6 years, wasn't it? Had you intended to keep it that long? Paul. Oh, no, no, no. With the Beatles, we did a big American tour. And I think the feeling, mainly from George and John, was, oh, this is getting a little bit, ugh. But I thought, no, you can't give up live playing. We'd be crazy to. But then we did a concert tour I really hated, and I came off Stormy and saying, bloody hell, I really agree with you now. Where was that? Paul, in America somewhere. I can't remember exactly. It was raining, and we were playing under some sort of big canopy, and everybody felt they were going to get electric shocks and stuff. We were driven off in a big truck afterwards. I remember sitting in the back of the truck and saying, bloody hell, they're right. This is stupid. So we knew we were going to give up playing, but we didn't want to go make some big announcement that we were giving it all up or anything. So we just kind of cooled it and didn't go out. When someone asked, we'd say, oh, we'll be going out again, but we really didn't think we would. So we recorded a lot of stuff, and nobody felt the need to go out and play. After 6 years, I just thought it would be good to get out, because live shows are a lot of what it's about. If nothing else, you get out there and see what people want. I remember at the end of the Beatles, thinking that it would be good if I just went out with some country and western group. To have a sing every day surely must improve my voice a bit. When you did start to play live again, were you very nervous? Paul. Yes, very nervous. The main thing I didn't want to face was the torment of 5 rows of press people with little pads all looking and saying, oh, well, he's not as good as he was. So we decided to go out on that university tour, which made me less nervous because it was less of a big deal. We went out on that tour, and by the end of that, I felt quite ready for something else, and we went to Europe. I was pretty scared on the Europe tour. That was a bit more of a big deal. Here he is, ladies and gentlemen. Sold all the tickets out. I had to go on with a band I really didn't know much. We decided not to do any Beatle material, which was a killer, of course, because it meant we had to do an hour of other material, and we didn't have it then. I didn't have something like My Love. That was sort of mine. I felt like everyone wanted Beatles stuff, so I was pretty nervous on that. By the end of the Europe tour, I felt better. And at the end of the British tour, I felt good. By the time we did the British tour, I knew we could get it easily and that I could get it going. Everyone digs it, and there's enough stuff not to be nervous. On the Wings tour, the one song you did from the past was Long Tall Sally. Paul. The first time I ever sang on a stage, I did Long Tall Sally. I must have been pretty young, probably 14. I feel like I might have been 11, I don't know. We went to stay with our parents at a holiday camp called Butlins, a branch in Wales. They used to have these talent shows, and one of my cousins-in-law had something to do with the entertainment. He called us up on stage. I had my guitar with me. I went up with my brother Mike, who had just recovered from breaking his arm and looked all pale. He had his arm in a big sling. We used to do an Everly Brothers number called Bye Bye Love. I think it might have been Bye Bye Love, in fact. We did that, and then I finished with Long Tall Sally. Ever since I heard Little Richard's version, I started imitating him. It was just straight imitation, really, which has gradually become my version of it as much as Richard's. I started doing it in one of the classrooms at school. It was just one of the imitations I could do well. I could do Fats Domino. I could do Elvis. I could do a few people. Paul smiles. I still can't. I'm walking, yes, indeed, I'm, does a Fats Domino impersonation. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, does an Elvis Presley impersonation. That's Elvis. When did you first think you wanted to be in a band? Paul. I didn't think I wanted to be in one. I wanted to do something in music, and my dad gave me a trumpet for my birthday. I went through trying to learn that, but my mouth used to get too sore. You know, you have to go through a period of getting your lip hard. I suddenly realized I wouldn't be able to sing if I played trumpet. It was about the time that guitar was becoming the instrument. So I went out and swapped my trumpet for a guitar, and I got that home and couldn't figure out what was wrong, and I suddenly decided to turn the strings around, and that made a difference, and I realized I was left-handed. Once you had a guitar, you were then kind of eligible for bands and stuff. But I never thought of myself as being in a band. One day I went with this friend of mine. His name was Ivan Vaughn, and I went up to Woolton in Liverpool, and there was a village fete on, and John and his friends were playing for the thing. My friend Ivan knew John, who was a neighbor of his. And we met there, and John was on stage singing, Come Little Darlin', Come and Go With Me. The Del Vikings Come Go With Me? Paul. But he never knew the words because he didn't know the records, so he made up his own words, like, down, down, down to the penitentiary. I remember I was impressed. I thought, Wow, he's good. That's a good band there. So backstage, back in the church hall later, I was singing a couple of songs I'd known. I used to know all the words to 20 Flight Rock and a few others, and it was pretty much in those days to know the words to that. John didn't know the words to many songs, so I was valuable. I wrote up a few words and showed him how to play 20 Flight Rock and another one, I think. He played all this stuff, and I remember thinking he smelled a bit drunk. Quite a nice chap, but he was still a bit drunk. Anyway, that was my first introduction, and I sang a couple of old things. I liked the band, and then one of their friends who was in the band, a guy named Pete Shotten, who was a friend of John's, saw me cycling up in Woolton one day and said, "Hey, they said they'd quite like to have you come into the band, if you'd like to join." I said, "Oh yeah, it'd be great." We then met up somewhere, and I was in the band. I was originally on guitar. The first thing we had was at a conservative club somewhere in Liverpool. I had a big solo, a guitar boogie. I had this big solo and I blew it. Sticky fingers, you know. I couldn't play at all and I got terribly embarrassed. So I goofed that one terribly. So from then on, I was on rhythm guitar, blown out on lead. We went to Hamburg and I had a real cheap guitar. It finally fell apart in Hamburg. Then I was on piano for a little while. So I went from bass to lead guitar to rhythm guitar to piano. I used to do a few numbers like Ray Charles' Don't Let the Sun Catch You Crying and a couple of Jerry Lee Lewis's like High School Confidential. Then Stuart Sutcliffe left the group. He was the bass player. He lent me his bass and I played bass for a few weeks. I used to play it upside down. And he used to have piano strings on it because you couldn't get bass strings. So he would cut these big lengths of piano strings from the piano and wind them on his guitar. So I played that upside down for a while. I'm pretty versatile. I'll give that to myself. I wasn't very good, but I was versatile. I'm in Hamburg, and I finally saved enough money to buy myself a Hofner violin bass. And I became known for that bass. A lot of kids got them. That was my big pride and joy, because it sounded great. And that was it, basically. The rest, you know. In America, the anthology album Beatles 1967 to 1970 and Red Rose Speedway were back-to-back number ones. You were replacing yourself. Did that strike you as odd? Paul, I thought it was good rather than odd, because obviously the big hang-up after the Beatles broke up was, and really still is, can any of them be as good as the unit? The answer in most people's minds, I think, is no, they can't, because the unit was so good. There was a lawsuit recently, the three others against Klon. Paul, of course I love that. My God, I hope they win that one. That's great. You see, apart from everything that went down, all the little personal conflicts, the reason why I felt I had to do what I had to do, which ended up specifically as being I had to sue the other three, was that there was no way I could sue Klein on his own, which is what I wanted to do. It took me 3 months to get over the fact. I kept saying, I can't sue the other three, just because it's very hard news to go suing someone you like. And no matter what kind of personal things were going down and John writing songs about me and all that stuff, I still didn't feel like the coolest thing in the world was to go and sue them. But it actually turned out to be the only way to stop Klein, so I had to go and do it. He was once quoted in New York Magazine as saying he was going to roast your ass. Paul, yeah, well, he never did, you know, and that's cool. He wouldn't get near my ass to roast it anyway, punk. You mentioned you had to sue the other three to get at Klein. What was Klein doing that made you have to sue? Paul, basically, I was being held to my obligations under an old contract. I would have to just sit, lump it, and let him be my manager, which I didn't want. So I was told that I could sue him. I said, great, I'll sue him. Then they said, there's one catch. You have to sue Apple. And that meant suing the other three. For 2 months, I sat around and kept thinking, I can't do this. Not that I didn't see the others. I did see them and kept asking them to let me out, and they said, no. Alan says there would be tax complications. I said, I don't give a damn about tax considerations. Let me go, and I'll worry about the tax considerations. I didn't want to be in ABCO-managed industry. It was weird. My albums would come out saying, an ABCO company, and Klein wasn't even my manager. As it turns out, it was the best thing, because that got the receiver in there and froze the money and gave everybody time to think about it. He still managed to get $5 million transferred to his own company, $5 million for management. There's a Rolling Stone footnote at this point that says the exact amount is subject matter of present litigation. He has a very special gift for talking his way. He'll use his Playboy interviews, and he'll probably ask for a Rolling Stone interview after mine. Even a murderer has a great line in his own defense, but he's nothing more than a trained New York crook. John said, anyone whose record is as bad as this can't be so bad. But that was Lennon-esque crap, which John occasionally did. Utter foolishness, grows more emotional. My back was up against the wall. I'm not proud of it, but it had to be done. To him, artists are money. To me, they're more than that. If Klein was the big reason for the breakup of Apple, do you think there would have been difficulties even if Klein had never been involved? Paul. I think there would have been difficulties had the Eastmans come in like I wanted. The others would have feared I was trying to screw everyone for the Eastmans. It could have been a bit hard for the others to swallow, I'm afraid, since the Eastmans were so close to me. But they didn't want to screw anybody, and the way it's turning out, they're settling up most of it anyway. Some people say, people are all the same in business, but they're not. I think the Apple thing was great. As it turned out, the one thing about business is that it does have to be looked after. If you have paperwork and bills and royalties and accounts and stuff, they all have to be handled very well, or else things get lost and then accountants have great difficulty in making up the final picture for taxes. Apple was together in a lot of other ways. Although he didn't get treated brilliantly at Apple, it was right for James Taylor to make his first record then. I think it was shameful of them to sue him afterwards, but I think that was largely Klein's instigation because of the way he works. He's kind of, okay, get the bastard. He's left us and he's a success. Let's sue him. We got him. We got his contract. But I still think all the records that came out of Billy Preston and James Taylor, Badfinger, Mary Hopkin, all the people we did take on all had very good records. George, even with the Radha Krishna temple, I think that's great stuff. I don't think you can fault any of the artistic decisions. Looking back on it, I think it really was a very successful thing. The main downfall is that we were less businessmen and more heads. There should have been the man in there who would tell us to sign bits of paper. We got a man in who started to say, come on, sign it all over to me, which was the fatal mistake. Had George invited you to the Bangladesh benefit? Paul. George invited me, and I must say it was more than just visa problems. At the time, there was the whole Apple thing. When the Beatles broke up, at first I thought, right, broken up, no more messing with any of that. George came up and asked if I wanted to play Bangladesh, and I thought, blimey, what's the point? We're just broken up, and we're joining up again? It just seemed a bit crazy. There were a lot of things that went down then, most of which I've forgotten now. I really felt annoyed. I'm not going to do that if he won't bloody let me out of my contract, something like that. For years there had been problems as to why the other three felt they couldn't just rip up our partnership agreement. I thought it was crazy if we had to split up as a band to have this piece of paper still going on. We were all tied into it, and I wanted to break it up, and they said, tax, you can't. Klein was saying, you can't do it, lads, you've got to stay together. And I think I know why he was saying it. He was telling the others it was a tax problem and it was impossible and stuff. There was an awful lot of that, and a lot of what I did around about then was just out of bitterness at all that. I thought, this is crazy. No one likes me enough to just let me go. Give me my little bit of the proceeds and let me split off. It was a little tit for tat. If you're not going to do this for me, I'm not going to do that for you. I tend to see the others now just for business. It's a bit daft, actually. That's why I'm so hot to get these business things over with. You were hoping to do it today, I gather. Paul, yeah, there was a little thing. You see, each time one of us will get hot for a meeting. Say me, I just got me visa and I got all hot for a meeting. I rang John up and John was keen to do it. He was going to fly in today from L.A. to New York. Great. I was going to be there. John was going to be there. Then I rang Ringo, and Ringo couldn't figure out what we were going to actually say outside of, hi there. And Ringo didn't want to come all the way to New York from England. He was just getting settled for Christmas. So he was a bit down on the ideas, and that kind of blew it out. Then I called John, and he said he was talking to George, and George was having some kind of visa problems. So it's a bit difficult to get the four of us all together, but it will happen soon. Now that you're in New York, I suppose the rumors will start again. There will be a Beatles reunion of some sort. Paul, well, I must say, like as far as getting together as we were, as the Beatles were, I don't think that'll ever happen again. Everyone's kind of interested in their little personal things. I kind of liked the way we did Band on the Run, something we've never done before, and it was very interesting. But I do think the Beatle thing was great, and I can go along with all the people you meet on the street who say you gave so much happiness to so many people. I don't think that's corny. At the time, obviously, it just passes over. You don't really think they mean it. But I dig all that like mad now, and I believe we did bring a lot of real happiness to the times. So I'm very proud of that kind of stuff, and consequently, I would like to see my past slagged off. So I would like to see more cooperation. If things go right, if things keep cool, I'd like to maybe do some work with them. I've got a lot of ideas in my head what I'd like. But I wouldn't like to tell you before I tell them. We couldn't be the Beatles back together again. But there might be things like good ventures we could get together on, mutually helpful to all of us and things people would like to see anyway. It's one of those questions I really have to hedge on. But, I mean, I'm ready. Once we settle all of our business crap, there's an awfully lot of money made, of course, and none of it came to us, really, in the end. Virtually, that's the story. So I'd like to salvage some of that and see that not everything's ripped off. Through all that kind of bitterness, I tended to think like John a bit. Oh, the Beatles? Nah, crap. But it really wasn't. I think it was great. So I'd like to see that cooled out and restored to its kind of former greatness. Agree that it was a good thing and continue in some kind of way. Would you consider the Ringo album an example of that type of cooperation? Paul. Yeah, but I think more than that. I think that's a beginning. That shows what someone can do just if he asks. That's all he did. He just asked us all. So that's what I like, that no one says, nah, you go on and make your own album. So if it's that easy, then lots of things could be done in the future. And I'd like to see some great things done. Our next article is entitled Flying High. Paul's first American tour in a decade was an arena-rocking success, even if he was nagged by lack of respect for his new band and persistent questions about his old one. This by Ben Fong Torres, and it's excerpted from Rolling Stone of June 17, 1976. It sure sounds like rock and roll, even if it is wings. Little Jimmy McCullough, former Thunderclap Newman, and Denny Lane, former Moody Blue, are burners on guitars. Joe English, former Nobody, is ecstatic on blistering drums. Linda McCartney, former photographer, punches away at a stockpile of keyboards and accounts for all the sound effects we've grown to love on all the Wings albums. And Paul McCartney, former Beatle, drives the whole album, plus a four-piece horn section. He cruises on bass, on piano. He hammers out Lady Madonna and Live and Let Die. Back on bass, he screams, reaching back for some of that Little Richard inspiration through Beware My Love and Letting Go. And after a particularly meaty, beady number, there is a shout from Lane or McCartney of rock and roll. It is the first American tour by Paul McCartney since 1966, when he was still a young you-know-what. along with John, George, and Ringo. He was supposed to have detested the audience's scream storms of wet panties that rushed them everywhere, from Shea Stadium in New York to Candlestick Park in San Francisco. Now, with the apple rot, Beatles split, lawsuits and bad mouthings pretty much behind them, Paul finds himself invoking the old days, inviting people to clap hands and stomp feet, waving and posing to audiences. But here in America in 1976, few try rushing the stage. First aid setups go untested. Security guards wind up turning down their walkie-talkies so they can hear the show. The only Beatle maniacal screaming is at the beginning, when Paul first appears out of the darkness. The one song that gets screeches, an absolute demonstration, in fact, is the quietest Beatle song of all. Saturday, May 8th. On the main floor of the CEDIA Olympia Stadium in Detroit, one young man keeps shouting for the people in front of him to sit down. We were into the acoustic set. After a few numbers, it is Paul alone on stage, tuning up for Blackbird. The man in the audience seems to know what's coming. "Sit down," he shrieks. "Sit down, you fuckers." Then he turns to a friend and explains his urgency. "I want to see Yesterday," he said. If you want the Beatles, go see Wings, George Harrison, November 1974. Paul McCartney doesn't mind a look back at Yesterday, but he is dedicated to two goals: the acceptance by public and press of Wings as a band, and not as a backup for a former Beatle, an acknowledgement from those same two difficult institutions that Wings and Paul are rock, not pop. But McCartney has some difficulties. First, he was a Beatle. He can't change or deny that. And he wouldn't anyway. "I'm a Beatles fan," he says later. "When John was saying a couple of years ago that it was all crap, it was all a dream, I know what he was talking about. But at the same time, I was sitting there thinking, no, it wasn't. It was as much a dream as anything else is, as much crap as anything else is. In fact, it was less crap than a lot of other stuff." And he agrees with George's equation of Wings and Beatles. Paul: "I wouldn't put it just like that. I'd say, if you want the Wings, go see Wings. If you want Beatles, look at an old film. But I probably was a little more sort of Beatle-minded than the rest. I tended to ring people up and say, let's work now, let's do this. So I suppose it's a fair point that that was my bag anyway. And I just continued doing it. Whereas George, roundabout Sgt. Pepper, he only did the one track on Sgt. Pepper. He didn't turn up for a lot of the other stuff, because he really wasn't that interested. And I'm still very interested." Another difficulty is that McCartney writes, sings, and produces in the pop market. Not that he wants to. Paul: "We're trying to make it sound as hard as possible." But sometimes you just don't bring off in a studio what you can bring off in a live thing. Also, Paul is a family man, married in 1969 to the former Linda Eastman. The kids, Heather, 13, by her first marriage, Mary, 6, and Stella, are taken along on most Wings tours. And this one is set up partly around the family situation. The McCartneys, band members, and closest aides are in four base cities, Dallas, New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles, and commute to and from concerts, 31 shows in 21 cities, by private jet. This saves on hotels, airports, and general wear and tear, and it keeps the family together. And finally, nothing, no new band he can concoct, can compare with the Beatles. This he knows well, as he patiently counseled a young reporter from NBC. Paul: "It may not be the 60s, but nothing's the 60s anymore, except the history books. It's the 70s, and it's hip, and it's happening. And it's just, enjoy it." McCartney and his wife and band have weathered 6 years of criticism and misunderstanding. They are consoled only by the record buyers and have sold millions of records like Hi Hi Hi, My Love, Hell in Wheels, Jet, Band on the Run, Junior's Farm, Listen to What the Man Said, and Letting Go. not to mention 7 albums, 5 under the name Wings. But commercial success is not enough. Paul says he ignores criticism, but he is thin-skinned to the point of writing silly love songs, an answer to the dismissal of his music as pop puffery. And Linda has long been abused, written off as a particularly successful groupie in her days as a rock photographer. As a musician and a member of Wings, she has been written off as a particularly successful etc. And she is, you can understand, very defensive. At the sound check before the first of the 2 concerts in Detroit, Linda is showing me around her keyboards, instruments she learned to play after marrying McCartney. Atop the electric piano are an ARP synthesizer and a mini Moog, which she plays for the opening of Venus and Mars. Buttons are labeled controllers, oscillator bank, mixer, decay time, modifiers for attack time. And the Mellotron is loaded with tape loops that are activated by depressing keys. There are tapes of Paul singing a line, "Till You Go Down," and of a laughing hyena, a pig, and a bull. Here, too, is the chorale behind McCulloch's number, Medicine Jar, and the robot, chainsaw, Moog, drum sound that opens Silly Love Songs, and the sounds of frying bacon and chips that appeared on Linda's Cook of the House, her first solo vocal outing on the most recent album, Wings at the Speed of Sound. I mention the criticism that is already built over her celebration of her place in the kitchen. My answer, she says, is always, fuck off. She continues in a weird hybrid of accents from England, New York, and finishing school. Linda. Look, we had a great loon in the studios that night. All the hung-up people don't have to buy it, don't have to listen to it. It's like having parents on your back. There's criticizing. I've grown up. I had a great night last night. This is a great band. And this is great fun. And that's all we care about. Sunday, May 9th. Paul McCartney has just flown into Toronto from New York and sped, in one of the customary 5 limousines, into the backstage area of the Maple Leaf Gardens. It is 6:20. The show has a scheduled 8 p.m. starting time, and he's been booked into a gold record presentation with Capitol Records EMI of Canada. Interviews with CBC TV, 2 radio stations, 1 Toronto paper, and Rolling Stone, and he should have dinner. But a rushed sound check in Detroit spoiled the first concert there, and he isn't about to let it happen again. He steps out of the Fleetwood, looks around, asks the closest person where the stage is, and heads off. Dressed in his usual offstage clothing, loud Hawaiian print shirt, tails hanging out of a short leather jacket, unfaded jeans, and rubber-soled shoes, he jumps from bass to keyboards to guitars to drums. He works meticulously, and by the time he's finished, it's 7:20. After a 10-minute break and a huddle with his manager, Brian Broley, he signals us into the dressing room for a double-speed interview that takes us up to the minute he has to switch to his stage outfit, a black suit with sequined shoulders. He gnaws at a fried chicken drumstick, waving his hands expressively and freely to emphasize points. Paul, there's this feeling that I should mind if they come to see me as a Beatle, but I really don't mind. They're coming to see me. I don't knock it. It doesn't matter why they came. It's what they think when they go home. I don't know for sure, but I've got a feeling that they go away thinking, oh, well, it's a band. It lets them catch up. I think the press, the media is a bit behind the times, thinking about the Beatles a lot. And I think the kids go away from the show a lot hipper than even the review they're going to read the next day. The whole thing behind Wings, says McCartney, is to get a touring band, so that we are just like a band instead of the whole Beatles myth. Wings is a talented group of musicians, especially with Lane and McCulloch. But the Beatles came to be considered geniuses in the studios. I wonder whether Paul misses the other 3 as sounding boards. He does miss the Beatles, he says. I think the Beatles was a very equal thing. Yeah, I used to worry a little more about that. Kind of saying to Linda, look, I know Denny's good, but he's not used to me enough. Will I dare offer him this riff? What if he turns it down? This standoffishness. But again, you consult your inner oracle and it tells you, well, it's time that does all of that. You can't take a baby and make him 14 overnight. Everyone is coming forward a bit more now. So I just thank me lucky stars that I hung in there. A year and a winter ago, another former Beatle went on tour and, to put it mildly, flopped. George Harrison had maturity, sincerity, and the best intentions on his side. He appreciated the Beatles, but he had grown up, changed, and did not care to dwell in the past. And to let everyone know how firmly he felt, he did a 2.5-hour show dominated by Indian music. He did 4 Beatles songs. And this only after active encouragement from fellow musicians on the tour. He changed lyrics in 3 of the 4 Beatles songs and rearrangements, along with George's overworked, hoarse voice, turned them into hardly reasonable facsimiles of the songs many in the audiences had wanted to hear. Paul and Linda attended Harrison's Madison Square Garden show, Paul disguised in an Afro wig, shades, and walrus mustache. And we loved it, he says. He agrees that George had the right at whatever critical cost to say, this is me now. McCartney has said he doesn't want to get into criticizing Harrison, but the producer in him finally wins out. Paul. If I'd been producing him and I'd been his impresario, he says, I would have asked him to do a few more songs he was known for, and also to stick to the arrangement a little bit. McCartney puts on a good-natured look, to which he'd probably say, piss off, and good luck to him. With the pressures between him and the other Beatles off, McCartney found the songs coming back. Paul, you think, well, they're great tunes. I like the tunes. When we played them, we'd get a bit nostalgic, I think. Ah, this is nice, isn't it? So I just decided, in the end, this wasn't a big deal. I'd do them. McCartney, in fact, is doing only one more Beatles song than George did on his tour. He selected the songs at random, he says, but the difference between Harrison and McCartney is in the faithfulness of Paul's arrangements, so that the horn section does a credible impression of a cello on Yesterday, and Lady Madonna is churned out happily, and The Long and Winding Road and Blackbird are almost straight off the records, only on I've Just Seen a Face, does he wander? In Toronto, there was a rash of reunion rumors. Scalpers outside were happily selling tickets for $50 and $60 apiece, while inside, film crews from as far away as London had their cameras ready. From the first show in Texas, there had been talk that the once-again friendly Beatles might do a friendly number together. In New York, where Lennon lives, similar talk persists. And in London, Yesterday, the single, leads a pack of 2 dozen Beatles reissues invading the pop charts. McCartney is pleased about Yesterday. Paul, it happens to coincide, luckily for us. It's bringing it to people's ears. That's the main thing, really, because if you're not in with a single or record, people just tend to forget. He is not wary of an acetate Beatlemania leading to even more fervent calls for a reunion. Paul, we maybe could be together for a thing, but it always feels like it would be a bit limp. In response to an American promoter's offer of between $30 million and $50 million for one Beatles concert, McCartney told a reporter he wouldn't do a reunion purely for money. Now he's qualifying that remark. Paul, the truth is very ordinary. The truth is that since we split up, we've not seen much of each other. We visit occasionally. We're still friends, but we don't feel like getting up and playing again. You can't tell that to people. They say, how about this money then? Or how about this? And you end up having to think of reasons why you don't feel like it. And any one of them taken on its own isn't really true. But I was just stuck for an answer, so I said I wouldn't do it just for the money anyway. And I saw John last time, and he said, I agree with that, but there's a million other points in there, a whole million angles. I know my feeling, and I think the other's feeling, in a way, is we don't want to close the door to anything in the future. we might like it someday. Again, talking to John before the tour, I'm saying to him, well, are you coming to the show at Madison Square? Well, he says, everyone's kind of asking me, am I going? Should I go? And I'm saying, oh God, that's a drag, isn't it? You just can't even come out and see our show. If anyone comes, they feel like they've got to get up. Then they get up. We've got to be good. Can't just get up and be crummy. Because then they say, the Beatles really blew it on the Wings tour, or something. So, but you see how long I've taken just to answer the question. God, it goes on forever. So you can see why I just wanted to say no. And yet, McCartney just cannot close the door. We've left it, he says. If John feels like coming out that evening, great. We'll try and get him in. Have it all cool. No big numbers. We'll just play it by ear. The Wings concert is a little contrived, not unlike, say, a Wings album. But I like artists who get out there and entertain. With a lot of help from Shoko, the Dallas-based sound and light company, McCartney has fashioned a show that reminds one of Elton John, especially when Paul's busying himself behind the Steinway, and has touches of The Who, David Bowie, and Led Zeppelin. For Wings, Shoko has provided touches like flying monitors. Monitor speakers hung from beams instead of placed on the stage floor, between musicians and audience, and a black plexiglass stage with platforms that illuminate in a tangerine glow, surrounded by dancing yellow bulbs. The laser machine from the last Who tour is here, projecting green beams against smoke from insect foggers for the last song, Soily. The emotional high point of the concert, of course, is Yesterday, but the showstopper is Live and Let Die, the song McCartney wrote for a Bond film. In concert, Wings attacks the audience with powder kegs, strobes, smoke, syncopated spotlights, and the laser machine gunning string beams of light from back of the stage to the opposite ends of the hall. And the music, teasing, then exploding into rat-a-tat violence, fully warrants the effect. Before the tour, the best guesses had Wings grossing $4.5 million for 28 shows in 20 cities. Since then, a huge show has been added in Seattle at the 60,000-capacity King Dome, and concerts have been added in Los Angeles and Chicago. The gross should be over $5 million, roughly $1 million more than the Harrison tour. But the net should be another story, given the lavishness of the stage show, the size of the entourage, and the private Braniff-leased BAC 1011 jet that flies the band back to a base city after every concert. After the concert, Brian Brawley, the manager, hustles the local reporters into the dressing room, apologizing all the way. They will have just about 2 minutes. McCartney, back in street clothes, greets them, looking relaxed and interested. He apparently wants to do this right, too. He shows them a painting a friend had done of him and Linda, and they proceeded to field a dozen questions about musical roots, the first time Linda saw Paul, that was at the Beatles concert in Shea Stadium, 1966, and of course the rumors about the Toronto Beatles reunion. Brawley gets itchy and clears his throat, and the room all at once, and the McCartneys scram into their limo and screech away. Outside, a knot of the faithful wave to them and come up with a modified ovation. It's not exactly Wings mania, and it is by no means Beatle mania, but it sure seems like rock and roll. We don't have time to get into another long interview article, so I'm going to do a couple of the sidebar items from the commemorative issue, and we'll get back to the interviews in our next recording. The first one is from the Rolling Stone Vault, February 21, 1980. Paul McCartney busted in Tokyo. The Japan arrest was the biggest drug bust of the longtime weed enthusiast. Paul McCartney was led off to jail in handcuffs after being arrested for possession of nearly half a pound of marijuana at Tokyo International Airport on January 16. As of press time, McCartney was spending his third night sleeping on a floor mat in Tokyo's Metropolitan Jail. He He had been denied permission to have a guitar brought to his one-man cell, but his associates were allowed to bring in extra blankets, a change of clothes, and hot food. McCartney was to stay in custody for up to 10 days while his background was investigated. If after that time no decision had been made on his case, the Tokyo prosecutor's office was prepared to request that he be held for a possible 10 more days. The former Beatle could be jailed for 7 years or fined up to $2,000 if convicted under Japanese drug laws. In New York, McCartney's attorney, Lee Eastman, described the situation as a hell of a mess. He's reportedly flown to Tokyo to coordinate McCartney's defense. An English-speaking Japanese lawyer, Tatsuko Matsuo, was also retained. "I wouldn't say it's a very serious case," observed one Japanese newsman. "It's only half a pound, which, if he consumed it himself, would only last, what, 3 or 4 weeks? McCartney and Wings had flown to Japan to begin a 2-week, 11-concert tour of the country. Customs officials allegedly found the 219 grams of marijuana, valued at nearly $3,000 on the local market, in plastic bags in one of McCartney's suitcases. They quoted him as saying he had brought some hemp for my smoking. Since there is no immediate bail in Japan, he was taken into custody. Linda McCartney and the couple's 4 children were not detained, nor were other members of Wings. "The press is sort of cool," said a Tokyo-based wire service editor. "They don't have the story on the front page, but there have been articles criticizing his bringing so much marijuana in. Some people are very mad." The aborted Wings tour was McCartney's first visit to Japan since the Beatles played there 14 years ago. He had been denied admission to the country 3 times because of his record of pot busts, in Sweden and Scotland in 1972, and again in Scotland in 1973 for growing marijuana on his estate. And we'll conclude with another sidebar item from the May 28, 1998 issue of Rolling Stone, entitled "Maybe She Amazed Him," remembering Linda McCartney, photographer, activist, and love of Paul's life. Linda McCartney, an accomplished photographer, an activist, and the wife of former Beatle Paul McCartney, died on April 17th after the breast cancer she'd suffered from since 1995 spread to her liver. She was 56. The child of a show business attorney and a mother who died when Linda was 18, Linda Eastman grew up in the affluent New York suburb of Scarsdale. In 1965, 2 years after the end of her first marriage, she moved to New York where she pursued a career in photography. While working as a receptionist at the magazine Town and Country in 1966, she swiped an invitation to a reception for the Rolling Stones and at the event took some of the most memorable early photographs of Mick Jagger and Brian Jones. Soon her work would appear in magazines including Rolling Stone. Her 1968 portrait of Eric Clapton graced the cover of the magazine's 10th issue. Ever resourceful, Linda slipped her phone number into Paul McCartney's pocket at a 1968 New York party. What may have begun as a liaison between a beautiful young photographer and a world-famous rock star soon matured into a profound, abiding love affair. Paul and Linda married in 1969 and grew inseparable. She became his favorite subject in song. From the shock of love's arrival in 1970's Maybe I'm Amazed to the autumnal fears of 1997's Some Days. And she frequently performed with him, most notably as a member of Wings. The couple shared passionate interests in animal rights, vegetarianism, and environmentalism, and both were extremely devoted to their children, Mary, Stella, James, and Heather, Linda's daughter from her first marriage. She went quickly, with very little discomfort, surrounded by her loved ones, Paul McCartney said in a statement. "I said to her, 'You are up on your beautiful Appaloosa stallion. It's a fine spring day, and we're riding through the woods. The bluebells are all out, and the sky is clear blue.' I had barely got to the end of the sentence when she closed her eyes and gently slipped away. Our next sidebar item is from the August 15, 2013 issue of Rolling Stone, entitled A Long Way from Shea Stadium, how McCartney puts together his career-spanning stadium concerts. Before every one of his solo tours, Paul McCartney roots around his back catalog, looking for rarely played tunes to spice up the set list. From this year's Out There World Tour, he picked three that he recorded with the Beatles in 1967, Lovely Rita, All Together Now, and trickiest of all, the swirling psychedelic vaudeville trip, Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, originally sung by John Lennon. Mr. Kite is such a crazy oddball song, and I have great memories of writing it with John, says McCartney. People say, oh, John wrote that one. I say, wait a minute. What was that afternoon I spent with him then looking at this poster? He laughs. But you've got to look what you're doing when you play that one. If I'd thought, tomorrow you're going to have to play this live when we recorded it, I don't think I'd have made the bass line so complicated. The Beatles stopped touring in 1966 in part because of technical frustrations. When they played places like Shea Stadium in New York, the sound was piped through tinny built-in speakers. God knows how the audience heard us, McCartney says. I don't think they did. Maybe that's why they were screaming. Today, his three-hour shows are state-of-the-art rock spectacles, complete with lasers and pyrotechnics, crystal clear sound, and a secondary stage that rises above the crowd. There's so many young people in there digging it, he said. Half of them know the words better than I do. Even after so many years on the road, there are still lots of Beatles songs he hasn't gotten around to playing live. That was a particularly rich period, he says. Think of songs like Why Don't We Do It in the Road that could go live. As for retirement, forget it. I can't imagine ever not touring, says McCartney. There's got to be some kind of physical limitation, but I haven't found it. The day after jamming with Nirvana's surviving members on five songs, including Helter Skelter and Let It Be, during a stadium gig in Seattle, he's buzzing with excitement. I did that show last night and I'm thinking, Jesus, God, man, you know, you're not 25. But then the other side of my head's going, yes, you are. Get on with it. This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Stone, rolling Stone.
Wanna see I-